So, it seems that today in the United States at least, it's Labor Day. And so I thought appropriate enough to talk a little bit about work, about labor. And when I was first introduced to Buddhism, I was mostly interested in the meditation practice. And I got started in the meditation practice after a few kind of false starts. And then I really took to it, really loved it, and found great value in it. And then once I started doing it in a committed way, I actually did it twice a day, I think 40 minutes in the morning and the evening. And I sat in a little garage in Davis. And I thought there was some kind of meditation phenomena. Every once in a while I see this black thing, kind of black shape, kind of whiz by here, sitting Zen style with my eyes open. I thought it was, you know, something had to do with meditation. I hadn't had much of a meditation experience. So I knew strange things could happen. And then, but one day I decided to look down, and it was a mouse. It went by. Well, that wasn't the point of today's talk, but... So I sat, you know, quite regularly, and my interest became how to then to engage in the world outside of meditation with the same sense of integrity, authenticity that I felt I had in sitting. Because I felt I tasted or got a touch of some sense of being at home in the world or integrity that I hadn't experienced so much in the rest of my life before from the regular sitting. And the question was how to live that in my life. I eventually ended up living at the San Francisco Zen Center, and as part of that quest, integrated into the rest of my life. And one of my surprises at the Zen Center was that they worked. And not only did they do a lot of work, but they also considered work to be part of the practice, as important as the meditation practice. And my years of living at Zen Center involved a lot learning about the practice of work, learning how to engage myself in work. And I'm very grateful for that time. And, you know, you could say kind of simply that the mind that you sit in meditation with is the same mind you do your work with. And the same activities happen in work as happen the same mental activity happens in meditation as happens in any other activity you do. So, for example, I noticed that, oh, it was very fascinating. So when I went to Tassajara, the Zen monastery, the first 3 months there, I was assigned to sanding. They have these wooden platforms everybody meditates on. They're kind of like, you know, platforms, but that high, those platforms there, but about half the depth into the wall. And they lined the whole Zendo, the whole meditation hall with these. And my job, I was given an electric sander. And my job was during the work time every day to go up to the shop and just sand this, you know, the top and the sides and get all the splinters out and make it really smooth so people could sit on it and not get splinters as they meditated. And it was fascinating to watch my mind as I did this activity. It had the virtue of being a repetitive activity. You do the same thing day after day. Because if you do the same thing day after day, it tends to highlight what goes on in your mind much more than if you do different things. And so... You know, sometimes my attitude doing the work was, oh, I'm here because I was assigned to be here. You know, sometimes my attitude was, you know, not much goes on in the monastery, I'm kind of bored with all this meditation, you know, and it's nice to get away and do something physical, you know. Or sometimes my attitude was, oh, this is going to be, you know, I've heard that work can be practice, so I'll get really concentrated. And I would just really try to be there, really concentrated on this intention of developing this great samadhi as I did my work. Mm-hmm. And other times my intention was to, you know, create a really smooth, beautiful platform for years and years and years. People would come and meditate. And, you know, they would get this, they wouldn't, they'd long forgot that I sanded those platforms. But, you know, they would have the benefit of this careful work of getting it real smooth. And so that was my intention some days. And so over the weeks, the months that I did it, my intention changed. And there's a world of difference in the intention we bring to the activities that we do And to see the intention, we bring and refine it and work on it and change on it, makes a huge difference. I mean, the same activity was being accomplished, but the inner work, the inner transformation that was going on, varies a lot depending on the intention that I brought to the work. If I was just bringing the idea, or I'm doing this because I was told to do it, versus I'm doing this in order to be of service to the people who are going to come after me, there's a very different inner ecology that's being created and being reinforced and developed and strengthened. If I'm doing this as Zen practice, which was the case back then, of putting myself into it to be fully present as I can, not to develop some great samadhi, but in a very matter-of-fact, easy way, be present for that one activity in order to discover freedom. That's a very different kind of intention, again, than just kind of like, let's just do something interesting because I'm tired of all this meditation. The intention we bring to what we do is very, very important. So what's the intention that you bring to your work? Or to your livelihood, or your vocation, the activities of your life? Certainly I want to say that labor, work, is much more broadly encompassing than just how we make our money. I'm fond of the fact that the word labor we use for giving birth. So, Labor Day. And also at Zen Center, I worked a lot in the kitchen, in kitchens there, and spent a lot of time washing dishes. I spent four-month period being the official Zen dishwasher. I should have my certificate in Zen training in dishwashing. And I loved it. And the idea of, of doing this one activity day after day after day and watching the mind, watching my activities, exploring what it's like to be engaged and be present. And every day, I was young and enthusiastic, and washing dishes was very forgiving because you came to the end of the day and you had to go to sleep. And then the next day there were new dishes. And so I wake up in the morning and say, oh, great, I get to try to do a better job. And the better job wasn't to wash the dishes better, but rather the better job was, how can I bring more of myself in a full embodied way? How can I do this work so that I don't get stressed, so that I don't get grumpy? How can I do this work so that, I do it in a way that's compassionate or kind or helpful to the people around me? For a while I was working at the Green's restaurant, and I was, this was happening at a time when I was in the fast food syrup line, I guess it was called, anyway, the back counter making the food. And I was making the sandwiches and the pizzas and serving them up. It was very fast paced. And there'd be all these waiter and waitresses that come up and grab the food and, put down their order, and there was, all these people activities going around me. And for a while, it was my intention to try to make a difference in everybody's life who I encountered. Could I say something in a way that didn't seem, kind of sugary or fake, but could I engage them in some way that they left my encounter with me happier or more, something, more peaceful, more at ease or something? And so I started having conversations with everyone. I tried to keep track of all these multiple conversations, like playing chess, 12 different, games at once. And so the intention there was, to make a difference in the people around me. The mind is not so different in work as in meditation. And what you'll see if you pay attention while you work is the mind often drifts off into fantasy, into distractions, into reactions, into all the different places the mind goes when it's doing meditation. And we have all these wonderful lists in the Buddhist tradition, like the five hindrances that are supposed to be specifically relating to meditation, the five hindrances to concentration. They're the five hindrances to being really present for our work also. And the five hindrances operate just as much in daily life as they operate in meditation. Hindrances of desire. Desire is tremendously powerful, pulls us away. The hindrance of aversion and all its manifestation, of restlessness, of resistance, sloth and torpor, and doubt. The virtue of doing things repetitively is the activities I found would often reflect the state of my mind. And it was most acute a period of time when I was sewing. I almost became the manager of the Zen Center stitchery. I missed it by that much. And I would have had a glorious career as a stitcher, as a tailor, but that wasn't to be. But I did a lot of sewing at Zen Center, and by hand, because you had to sew your own robes, and so you had to sew these, you know, and you had to do a little mantra for every stitch. So it wasn't just like, you can't get through it quickly. You had to say, in Japanese, you had to say, I take refuge in Buddha, Namu Kiyi Butsu. And it was fascinating to see that my state of my mind was reflected in the stitch, each stitch. And I can go back, you know, I couldn't remember that many stitches back, but I could look back, you know, a row of, you know, 20 stitches and see, oh, that's when my mind wandered. That's where I got kind of, you know, nervous while I was doing it, and I had these really tight stitches, and this is where I left a straight line, and this is where I wasn't paying much attention, I was spaced out, and the stitches got kind of broad. The work we do, you know, all these things come into play, as happens in meditation. And one of the advantages and one of the benefits of learning to meditate is we learn to watch the mind, the activities of the mind, and become very familiar with it so we can recognize it outside of meditation. And so they don't lead us around by the nose, but rather we have some mastery over ourselves in these situations where we come back to being present, we don't give in to the hindrances, we don't give in to desire or aversion, but keep the course in what we're doing. One of the great things about working at Zen Center was they had bells. Everything, you know, a lot of things were, during the day, the stages of the day were marked in bells. So they'd ring a bell and you had to get up in the morning. They'd ring a bell and then you'd have to hurry to get to the Zendo. They'd ring a bell and then you'd sit down. They'd ring a bell and you'd get up. They'd ring a bell and then you'd bow. They'd ring a bell and you'd leave. They'd ring a bell and you'd open your bowls. You'd ring a bell and it'd serve you. They'd ring a bell and then you'd bow and then you'd eat. And they ring a bell, you had better be finished by that eating. And then you clean your bowl and they ring the bell and then you put it away. And then they ring a bell and you stand up. And then they ring a bell. And then they ring a bell and you go up to your room for a little while and change and take a little break and have some tea. And then they ring a bell and you come to work meeting. And then they ring a bell. And at some point they ring a bell, you're working, and they ring a bell and it's the end of work. And the rule in the monastery is that when the bell rings, you stop and go to the next activity. So you have to do a little bit of preparation. You didn't just abandon your tools kind of in the middle of the road or something, but sometimes there's a warning bell. But but the idea was that the idea of just stopping and not being attached to what you're doing. The idea was to be fully engaged in what you're doing, but then not be attached to it. And somehow, for me at least, that bell that marked the end of the period, you know, it didn't matter how far I'd gotten on my sanding that day. The bell rang, I had to put it away, and I'd come back the next day and continue. One of the things I loved about working at Zen Center was we were given lots of different jobs over the, you know, people who lived there. Sometimes at the monastery, we were given a new job every 3 or 4 months. And my reflection back then was that, you know, many people have like one job, at least used to be at least, one job they have their whole life, one career perhaps. And at Zen Center, it seems like I had a new career every 3 or 4 months. You know, I was a, you know, sander for 3 months. I was a dishwasher, I was a cook, I was a gardener, I was glorified altar boy for a while, rang bells and made flower arrangements for the altar and things like that. And I was a work leader, I was a guest manager, I was, I did a lot of different activities at Zen Center. And my feeling was that in each of these different activities, a different part of who I was came out. A different part of me was challenged. And if I'd just taken one of those jobs, if I'd just been a cook for the rest of my life, I would have been challenged in my role as a cook, that my personality, that part of me would have been challenged and I would have learned. But then I would have gotten into a groove, in a sense, or I would have kind of... But by shifting jobs, a whole different part of me, you know, was challenged. So, you know, I didn't know anything about cooking, and so I was put in the kitchen. That was often the tendency at Zen Center. If you knew something, if you had some career or job you did before coming to Zen Center, they would absolutely not give you that. It's changed a little bit nowadays, but back then they were kind of strict about this. If they knew that you had been a cook, no way they were going to make you a cook in their kitchen. Then they'd make you a treasure. you know. Or so I didn't know anything about cooking, so they made me. They put me in the kitchen, and so that went fine for about 3 months. And then they made me a kitchen manager, and I didn't know anything about managing people. And so that was a whole kind of like, I was a manager type, and that was a whole job in itself. And I learned a whole. I mean, that was really difficult. One of the most challenging things at Zen Center was being the kitchen manager. It took me about 9 months to learn how to do it. They kept me there for 9 months, rather than rotating me. You know, they kept me 9 months. And just at the end of that 9 months, I had a sense I was just getting the hang of it. And then you know what they did, of course. They you know, rotated me out of the kitchen. That was it. But then they rotated me out of the kitchen, and then I wanted so much. I got into this groove. I spent a whole year in the kitchen. And I got into this groove where I really wanted to cook. I loved cooking, and I loved that kind of activity. And so, and the most prestigious thing to do in the kitchen at Tassajara was to become a summer guest cook. If you've never been to Tassajara, it's a beautiful. In the summertime, it's a resort, and people go there. It's this beautiful resort in the summer where they have hot springs and all these ambience of a Zen monastery, which is kind of unusual, and this tremendously good food. And it's the guest cooks who cook that. So I'd been a whole year in the kitchen, managing the kitchen, watching the other guest cooks do this wonderful work and creative work and making these great dishes. And I thought, oh, next year, next summer, they'll certainly assign me to be the guest cook. You know, I'm one of the best cooks going at Tassajara. I worked really hard for a year. I learned the job really well. I'm really fast. I'm really good, I thought. And I spent the whole year thinking about menus. Not the whole time, we have this in Zen. They had this choreographed way of eating in the meditation hall, kind of like up on a platform like this, right? And there's less space like this in front of you, and you have these bowls that are wrapped in cloth, and you have a particular way of unwrapping them and spreading them out very neatly, and laying the spoon just so, and you know, just it, you know, it puts the Queen of England to shame, you know, just the way it's so exact. And you sit there often just waiting for something to happen. You lay out your bowls, they're empty. You sit there and you sit and meditate for a while. And then someone comes with food in the first bowl and they plop it in. And you say thank you. You bow in gratitude after you sit and wait until the next person comes. You sit and meditate. Someone comes. It's not like you're eager to eat because you're not allowed to eat until they ring the bell. And so you're sitting there, and so all this food, beautiful food sitting in front of you, getting cold. And then they ring a bell and you chant, and then you eat, and then you finish, and then you sit and wait for them seconds to be served. And you're waiting and waiting, if you eat fast, like I do. And then you eat seconds, and then you wait, and you clean your bowl, and you wait for the water to come. Anyway, so there's a lot of time there just meditating. And it was that's when I thought about menus and thought about, you know, beautiful recipes and stuff. And I was preparing myself because I was convinced they were going to make me the guest cook for the next summer. And it was so instructive, of course. You know this is what happened, right? I didn't become the guest cook. I was so surprised when the beginning of the summer started and they gave people their assignments. I wasn't assigned there at all. And something completely different. But the realization I had was, what a wasted year. all those hours of sitting at those meals, having my thoughts be carried away, swept away, absorbed, lost, compulsively thinking about menus and planning them. And there were much better things to have done with my life than spend the year thinking about menus. And it kind of hit me in the face so dramatically. What am I doing with my mind? What do I spend my time with my mind doing? Do I want to just let my mind do whatever it wants freely? Maybe. Or is there some way of kind of adjusting that stream of the mind so it becomes more useful? And I think that we can, in a very honest and realistic and helpful way, change the streams of our thinking so it becomes more useful, more helpful for us. A year of thinking about the same thing? I mean, we're so repetitive in our thoughts. It's really amazing, right? The story I say in the intro class. If someone went around talking to me as much as I talk to myself, came right next to my ear, talking away, you know. I would be begging them to stop. That would be if I was polite. You know, I'd be bribing them, I'd be threatening them, you know, and I think they were crazy. And, you know, and it's that one thing, they're always talking, but these people, the guy is he's saying the same thing 500 times. I mean, you know where people like that belong, don't you? And it's like my mind goes on and on. And of course, the most amazing thing of all is that the 500th time, I'm still interested when it's inside my own mind. So the idea that, you know, to watch our mind, what does your mind do? And it's such an amazingly precious potential, our mind, and the direction it takes and what we do with it. What I learned at Zen Center about work was more than just the direction of my mind, pay attention to it, but also was very much about what was the investment of myself in the work. I learned to bring my body into it. And what I learned in Zen practice was how I am in work. At Zen Center, how you were was considered more important than what you did. So, you know, cleaning the toilets was, you know, at some point, doing, it's a little bit ritualistic. Zen is full of ritual. Much more than anybody who's read Alan Watts would realize. But so at some point you graduate through the ranks and you become the head monk. And it's kind of like you're on the brink of starting to become like a Zen teacher. So at some point I became the head monk for a 3-month period. Symbolically, the head monk is supposed to be the servant of everybody else. And so this head monk's work for the practice period is to clean the toilets and mix the compost. And so the idea, and one of the inspiring things I saw at Zen Center was people who were the president of Zen Center, like Ed. Remember, some of you know Ed Brown, a great Zen priest from Zen Center. He lived there for years and years and years, and went up through all the ranks of Zen Center, eventually became the president of Zen Center for many years and did a wonderful job as president. And then he stopped being president. And he was one of the senior teachers at Zen Center, also as a priest. And when he stopped being president, he went to work at Greens, back when Greens was part of Zen Center. And it was a busboy for a year or some time. And I just love that model, you know, that after you become CEO of, Xerox Corporation, right, for a while, then, you do that for some years, but you expect it after a while to go become the janitor for a while. And that kind of rotation, that, you know, what you did was not so important. And certainly you want to be careful about the investment of your ego in the work that you did. What was important was how you were in the work. And so how was what was important. And that's one of the things I learned at Zen Center, was the investment of the how. And so the most dramatic place I learned this was at the kitchen at Tassajara, especially in the first 3 months when I was kind of regular kind of prep cook. And I started paying attention to my body. Actually, just before I went to Tassajara, I think it was on the way down there, just before, we stopped at a bookstore someplace, and I opened a book kind of in the middle of it. There was a book by... Dafrijan. That's what he was called back then. He's changed his name a few times. Back then it was Dafrijan. And a spiritual teacher of the Hindu, coming out of the Hindu tradition. And I just opened his book at random. And I read this little line that said something about, I don't remember so well, but it was something about most of our problems come from not from holding ourselves back from life, holding ourselves back. So I read that thing, closed the book, and basically went to the monastery without echoing. And when I was put in the kitchen, that echoed a lot. And I didn't like the way it was worded, so I reworded it for myself positively. How can I be more fully engaged in what I'm doing? And so the kitchen was a great place for doing that. And I would stand there at the table, chopping carrots. And carrots were my great teacher, or onions, or broccoli, whatever it was. And I would try to bring my whole body into doing that simple chopping thing. And it surprised me how much I didn't want to bring my whole body in. That wasn't my habit, wasn't my inclination. And sometimes I noticed that my body would be turned away, kind of like 45 degrees from the table, one hand kind of chopping. And it's like my left side was like pointing towards the door. Let's get out of here. You know, I didn't really want to be there or something. And so I would turn around and really be there, and kind of really face that carrot, you know, me and the carrot, and try to meet it with my full presence, my full body, and my posture, let my posture really be there for it. One of the things that was great about working at Zen Center, especially there in the kitchen, was the value given to working in silence. Because the emphasis was on really being present for your work in an absorbed way, and as fully as you could, idle conversation was considered a distraction. So there were often periods of time we'd work in silence. In the morning, the kitchen was often a silent place. And I love that the value of silence really being absorbed and not having. Oh, so I worked in the kitchen there at Tassajara for a year, or I think for about 6 months. All the silence, you know, the Zen silence and full involvement. And then I hiked over to the coast from Tassajara over the Big Sur Mountains, because Tassajara had an exchange program with Eslon, which we could hike over to respective center and stay there for a night. So I hiked over there and stayed there for a night. And the next, when I woke up in the morning, I went. I was very curious to see their kitchen. And I thought, well, you know, it's another retreat center of sorts. I went to the kitchen in the morning, and I had to almost leave immediately. I came to the door and was almost like recoiled, because they had this rock music blasting away, and the people were, you know, singing and, you know, dancing in there, and it felt so different from the Zen kitchen. I don't know which is best, but certainly was very valuable for me to spend that time working in silence and learning how to, you know, because it really helped me, this idea of bringing my body, bringing myself, investing myself, how I am, not just what happens with my mind, but how I am is important. Which brings me to an interesting observation. I was a monastic in Zen monasteries in Japan also for a while. And then I became a monastic practicing in monasteries in Southeast Asia. I lived in monasteries in Thailand, for example, in Burma. And in both traditions, both the Zen tradition in Japan and the monastic tradition in Thailand, the monks spend a lot of time raking the monastery. It's like one of the favorite activities. They do it a lot. And in Zen, of course, you didn't even have to have leaves to rake. What was important was to rake. And literally, we were sent out to rake sometimes. There were no leaves, and you couldn't say there's no leaves, so I can't rake. Then that was really a faux pas. You had to be engaged in doing the work, because engagement was what was important. So you would rake the non-leaves. And then if they send out too many people to rake the leaves, then not only would be no leaves, but you'd have to rake over where someone had just finished raking. Because you had to be engaged, you had to be involved, you know, until they rang that bell. And that is ritualized temple cleaning in the morning in Japan. It lasted about 15 minutes. And that's where you did things that sometimes were redundant. And also in Thailand, the monks spend a lot of time raking. What was interesting, the observation, is a different attitude that the monastics brought in the two traditions. They both share a lot of emphasis on mindfulness and being present. But the emphasis in the Zen monastery was being absorbed in the activity that you were doing. The emphasis in the Thai temple was to be mindful while you did it. And it lent itself to a little bit of a different way of doing it, at least initially. I think when you got really mastered, maybe it became the same thing. But the Thai monks tend to do things slowly, very present, very mindful of the inner states, their mind, mindful that their mind doesn't wander away, and keeping it present, very attentive to the details of what they're doing. In Japan, they did things carefully, but they tend to do things vigorously. And the idea was to throw yourself into it as fully as you could, and lose yourself, in a sense, in the activity. By being so vigorously engaged in the activity, your mind couldn't wander away. So it's a different kind of way of practicing. They're both beautiful. I've done them both. I think they're both really great ways of doing work, of doing activity, doing cleaning. What I want to say here now is that in both traditions, how they did their work was what was important. They maybe had different hows, but the how they brought to their activity was what was really important. It isn't that they weren't just doing things casually, doing things on rote, automatic pilot, doing things kind of without, you know, considering how they were. They weren't doing it in order to get it over with quickly. They were doing it because the doing, the work itself, had spiritual value. The activity itself was a place of training. We're training ourselves to wake up, training ourselves to be present, training ourselves in this developing of spiritual qualities. The understanding that I got, especially from my Zen training, but also you see that a lot in the Thai monasteries, is that the path of practice, the path of Buddhism, is negotiated with in any activity that you're doing. Reality is the teacher. And whatever you have to be doing, ideally, is the place where your spiritual practice is found. The how you are is worked out in whatever your activity you're doing. So that in the monastery, you spend a lot of time, for example, meditating, and a lot of times chanting. But chanting and meditating and doing all these wonderful kind of so-called spiritual things in the monastery have no greater value than meditating at home. People who have urban lives and work during the day have no greater value than getting up in the morning and making breakfast for your kids and getting to school or wiping the snot off your kid's nose. It has no greater value than, you know, getting your oil changed or getting, cleaning your dishes or going to work and doing your work that you do. Reality is our teacher, and how we are is the important issue. So work then becomes a place of practice. And since most of us spend most of our... some people don't work or work very little or whatever, but a lot of people spend a lot of their work time, their daily life at work. 8 hours a day, 6 hours a day, 16 hours a day, whatever. There's a lot of time spent at work. And much of human life is taken up with work. We can make it part of our spiritual life by being concerned about how we are when we do it, by bringing some of the principles of spiritual life into that, paying attention to our intention, what's the intention you're doing to it, with it, paying attention to our attention. What's the quality of the attention that you bring to the work that you're doing? Paying attention to how you are, the investment of self, the investment of your body, of your soul, of your heart, of your mind. How do you bring it together? How do you meet this present moment? To wake up, to learn to be free, to learn to be of service to the world around us through the work that we do, I think is one of the ways to make lay life outside of the monastery as powerful as monastic life. If we don't take our work life as a place of spiritual practice, then the monastery is going to be a much, much more powerful place to do spiritual practice, because it's kind of like something you do it all day long. But if you can do it at work, you bridge that gap dramatically. And sometimes I recommend to people that they think of their place of work as their monastery. And when they go into their work, they should, make it their monastery. The last thing I want to say about work, if I may, is more of a sociological observation. I've read that, this is something I've read, so hopefully it's true, that the productivity of the American worker has increased threefold in the last about 60 years, 50 years. Means that American worker can do in one-third amount of time what it, you know, if it took 3 hours to do something 50 years ago, it takes 1 hour to do it now. So they can get their work done in a third of the time it did 50 years ago. But people aren't working a third less. In fact, what they're actually the hourly work week in America is increasing. Has been increasing. I mean, in the last couple of years, maybe it's dropped again a little bit, but it's been on the upswing. It seems that it reached kind of like the low in the 60s or so, 50s, 60s. Apparently, it was the average work week in the mid 19th century was 70 hours a week, and then somewhere in the 50s and 60s, it got down to about 40. And then by the late 80s or so, it had gotten up to about 60, I was told. I don't know, you know, if this means just Silicon Valley, or I don't know how, you know, where this means, but it's on the upswing. And while the productivity has been increasing, and I know a lot of people suffer from a lot of work stress from working so much, I think employers love the fact that, you know, they give people salaries rather than hourly wages. They get free labor. Because if your salary, you expect it to work extra 2 or 3 hours a week or a day or whatever. And there's something about the American work ethic. Oh, so back to Zen Center and the work ethic. One of the amazing surprises to me at Zen Center was to see how the American work ethic followed us all there. And it was it was almost like neurotic. So we had this great emphasis on work as practice, but people didn't feel like it was okay to get sick at the monastery because they had to do their work. And so people were, pushing themselves beyond limits. And there were times when people really kind of felt that they couldn't kind of be sick because they had to get their work done. And this push to get, to work at all costs, even follow people to the Zen Center. And hopefully, after a while, the monastic life purified them of that. But sometimes it seems to take, it took some people a long time. Some people just really, was pushing, and they push other people. And so the American work ethic is a beautiful part of American culture, and it's also a part of American culture which has caused a lot of suffering and stress. So how is it that we work? What is the way that we work? What's the value we see in our work? The emphasis from a Buddhist practice point of view is how you are is more important than what you do. Even if your work is to help other people, how you are is more important than what you are, what you're doing. And here it might be that rather than I've seen a lot of people whose job is to be of service to others, to be helpful to other people. And they're so grumpy, they're so miserable, so stressed out, that they might be helping in some way, but you kind of, people who contact them can kind of like, it's kind of like a little bit downer to be around them. How you are is important. If you want to be friendly and helpful, then be in a friendly mode. Don't be in a grumpy mode. If you want to be, how you are when you encounter another person perhaps is more important than what you do for them. So the how you are, in Buddhist spirituality, the how you are over and over again takes precedence. And then I'll end with an interesting koan, a piece of advice I was given by my father when I was a teenager. And he said to me that if you don't enjoy what you're doing, you can't help anybody. Isn't that nice? So that I don't know if that's true, but I've carried that with me as my koan ever since, and reflect on that and think about that. If I'm not enjoying what I'm doing, how can I help anybody? And it's possible that someone who has, you know, who finds great joy in something which doesn't really help people too obviously, what they're bringing to the world is their joy. And it's tremendously helpful to have people in this world who are joyful, who enjoy what they're doing. So if what you're doing is could be almost anything. If you have some burning passion, the overriding passion in your life, nothing else could possibly matter at all but stamp collecting. If that brings you a lot of joy, then hopefully that joy is contagious to others and is an example to others that hopefully we should find joy in our activities. If what you want to do is to be a compassionate service to all beings, bodhisattva who helps everybody, please be a bodhisattva with joy. How you are is important, maybe more important than what you do. So enjoy your labors, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.